Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Dave Eggers has written famously about his own life. He's written about real life in Sudan. Now he's written about a life in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. When Katrina hit New Orleans, Abdulrahman Zaytoun stayed in the city to care for his business and properties. He paddled down flooded streets in a canoe, helping stranded survivors and feeding abandoned dogs, until he was arrested and held without explanation in a nightmarish, purpose-built prison. This hour on Point, Dave Eggers tells a harrowing true story in his new book, Zaytoun. You can join the conversation. Have you followed Dave Eggers' career? Did you read about his story of the Lost Boys of Sudan? Are you eager to read his investigation into the aftermath of Katrina? You can also comment on our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook, at On Point Radio. And joining me now from San Francisco is author Dave Eggers. He's the founder of the independent publishing house McSweeney's and the author of several works of fiction and nonfiction, including What is the What? And the breakthrough memoir, A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius. And he co-wrote the film Away We Go, which was released earlier this summer, as well as the upcoming adaptation of Maurice Sendak's Where the Wild Things Are, to be released in October. He's co-founder of 826 Valencia, a nonprofit writing and tutoring organization for kids up to 18, a busy guy. But, Dave, we're here to talk about your new book, Zaytoun, and our listeners can read an excerpt of the book on our website at On Point Radio. .org. Thanks very much for taking the time from that list of activity to talk about Zaytoun and to be with us.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
He is an extraordinary story, and there are few individuals, I think, who can go as concisely from post-Katrina and what happened in this country, 9/11, back to the Middle East. Why don't you introduce us to Abdulrahman Zaytoun, how you found out about him and why he riveted you, which he obviously did.
At McSweeney's, we have a series called Voice of Witness, which is tries to illuminate human rights crises around the world through oral history. So we've done a number of books from wrongfully incarcerated men and women in the U.S. To other victims of the Sudanese civil wars. And one of the books that we did was called Voices from the Storm, which followed 13 New Orleanians before and during and after Katrina. The Zaytoun family was one of the stories told in that book. And he had maybe 8 or 10 pages of that book. His story really struck me as having this sort of unique only at that time in history could his story have happened, or it seemed to me that it was like this very particular intersection of the war on terror and the government's reaction to Katrina.
And let's think about who he is and how he came there and what happens to him.
Well, he's been in the country for 25 years or so. He's originally from Syria, from the coast of Syria, a little town called Jable, a fishing town, and he's from a fishing family. And he came here after spending 10 years or so on ships as a sailor, on tankers and merchant vessels, and he became a contractor and builder. He knew basically every trade there was from growing up. A lot of people in his family were masons and painters and you name it. So he became a very successful painter contractor in New Orleans, running a business out of his home with his wife, Kathy. After the storm, he stayed to protect that business and a lot of the rental properties that they owned around the town.
The cover of the book shows him in his canoe going around town. He stays in New Orleans after his wife and family are sent away. But I'd like to go back to Jable, which you also visited, because one of the lovely things that you do in this fascinating and, I must say, talk about heartbreaking account is tell us the Syrian side of his boyhood as well and what makes him the man he is today, the American he is today. We like to think of people of great character and toughness coming here. And this was he was once a little boy in a fishing village. Could you read from that part of your
book? Yeah, this is how the book begins. It starts in his hometown in Syria when he's just a young boy. This is how it begins. On moonless nights, the men and boys of Jable, a dusty fishing town on the coast of Syria, would gather their lanterns and set out in their quietest boats. Five or six small craft, two or three fishermen in each. A mile out, they would arrange the boats in a circle on the Black Sea, drop their nets, and, holding their lanterns over the water, they would approximate the moon. The fish, sardines, would begin gathering soon after, a slow mass of silver rising from below. The fish were attracted to plankton, and the plankton were attracted to the light. They would begin to circle, a chain linked loosely, and over the next hour their numbers would grow. The black gaps between silver links would close until the fishermen could see, below, a solid mass of silver spinning. Abdurrahman Zaytoun was only 13 when he began fishing for sardines this way, a method called lampara, borrowed from the Italians. He had waited years to join the men and teenagers on the night boats, and he'd spent those years asking questions. Why only on moonless nights? Because, his brother Ahmed said, on moon-filled nights the plankton would be visible everywhere, spread out all over the sea, and the sardines could see and eat the glowing organisms with ease. But without a moon, the men could make their own and could bring the sardines to the surface in stunning concentrations. You have to see it, Ahmed told his little brother. You've never seen anything like this. And when Abdurrahman first witnessed the sardines circling in the black, he could not believe the sight, the beauty of the undulating silver orb below the white and gold lantern light. He said nothing, and the other fishermen were careful to be quiet, too, paddling without motors, lest they scare away the catch. They would whisper over the sea, telling jokes and talking about women and girls as they watched the fish rise and spin beneath them. A few hours later, once the sardines were ready, tens of thousands of them glistening in the refracted light, the fishermen would cinch the net and haul them in.
It's a wonderful story, beautiful description of his connection to water, to fishing, to self-sufficiency more than anything, which is what takes him from the Syrian coast, and we should remind people Syria is, of course, a Mediterranean country, to the Gulf Coast. And you have a great passage also. There's a lot of oral history, a lot of people, you have done thorough reporting here through your own and other efforts about their family life, where he's come to America and he doesn't have a car. He has a bicycle. It breaks down and he's running to the job with the broken bicycle on his back and his boss sees him.
Yeah, he worked for a guy for one of his first jobs as a young, you know, contractor, as a builder. Was with a guy that in the book we called Charlie Saucier, and he, we changed his name. But Zaytoun was such a hardy worker, and he's just the hardest worker that you'll ever meet. And he couldn't get his bike, had a flat tire. He was carrying the bike on his back, running across town. He had a few miles to go just to get to the work site on time. And his boss pulls up in the truck next to him, and Zaytoun assumes it's somebody just making fun of the guy running along the road with a bike on his back, and it's his boss. And his boss tells him to throw the bike in the back and he'll drive him to the site. And it was just a sign that, you know, this boss had so many workers who he couldn't count on necessarily showing up on time or at all. And here's this guy who's so worried about being on time on the dot that he's running with a bike strapped to his back. And so it's just a lesson in that, you know, Zaytoun played by the rules. He worked hard. He did everything he could. And he grew this business basically based on an incredible work ethic.
And also, after the he marries an American Muslim woman. They have three children of their own and her son by her first marriage. You take us very, very beautifully into their family life, the intimacy of the marriage, the ordinariness of trying to run a business and be a self-employed business person and raise the children. And after the hurricane hits, he's back in a certain sense in Syria, in out on that ocean. At first, the water's very clear. He's out with the canoe, and he feels that God has a mission for him, and that's to save people.
Well, it's, you know, his ancestral home of the Zaytoun family is Arwad Island, this tiny island off the coast of Syria that is maybe 10,000 people, but it doesn't look like it could possibly hold that many. It's like a mile all around. And it's just this rock, you know, a few miles out of the off the coast. And And then, you know, Hurricane Katrina hits and the water comes up into his neighborhood. It didn't come up until Tuesday. And suddenly his home is an island of its own in a way. And he had bought this secondhand canoe that Kathy, his wife, had kind of made fun of him for buying. What are you ever going to do with a canoe? And suddenly this canoe sort of spoke to him, like, well, you know, it served a very distinct purpose. He gets in the canoe and he began making what he called his rounds, where he would go around the neighborhood and the city at large, checking on his own properties, on his clients' homes, his friends' homes, and then very soon realizing that he can be of use. And even on that first day, he and a neighbor who he had picked up and was in his canoe with him, they were able to save the life of an elderly woman. And from that moment on, he was quite sure that he had been put in that city after the storm by God to help.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking with author Dave Eggers about his new book, Zaytoun, which tells the story of Abdulrahman Zaytoun and his family in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. Dave, would you begin this part of the show by reading about Abdulrahman canoeing around the flooded city?
Well, I'll read. This takes place on Monday, August 29th, when in his neighborhood in Uptown, there wasn't much water yet, even though the water was coming up around the city. It took some time to get to his neighborhood, so this is his first attempt to use the canoe. In the afternoon, the wind and rain calmed. Zaytoun went outside to explore. It was warm, over 80 degrees. He estimated there were 18 inches of water on the ground. It was rainwater, murky and gray-brown, but soon he knew it would drain away. He looked in the backyard. There was the canoe. It called to him, floating and ready. It was a rare opportunity, he thought, to be able to glide over the roads. He had only this day. He bailed the water resting in the hull, and in his T-shirt and shorts and sneakers, he stepped in. Leaving the yard was difficult. A tree across the road had been ripped from its roots and lay across the road, branches spread over his driveway. He paddled around them and looked back to the house. No great damage to the exterior. Some shingles missing from the roof, the windows broken, a gutter that would need remounting. Nothing too bad, 3 days' work. In the neighborhood, other homes had been hit by all manner of debris. Windows had been blown out. Wet, black branches covered cars, the street. Everywhere trees had been pulled out of the earth and lay flat.
We're speaking with acclaimed author Dave Eggers, author of the new book, Zaytoun, and joining us now from New Orleans by the subject of Eggers' book, Abdulrahman Zaytoun. He's the owner of Zaytoun, a painting contractors. He stayed in New Orleans as Hurricane Katrina hit to take care of his business and properties. He was arrested and held in Camp Greyhound, the makeshift prison set up in the early days after the storm at the bus station in downtown New Orleans. Abdulrahman Zaytoun, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
This is an extraordinary story, or perhaps that's the sad thing in it, is that it shouldn't have been happened at all. Tell us what happened to you after the initial days of you being alone in your neighborhood, reaching out to others.
Okay, and after Katrina over, the hurricane over, I start, like Mr. David say, I walk around my house and look what damage is happening. I brought my canoe and I said, let me go check and see what happened around my property. And first trip, I got out and start going north to Cleveland Avenue. And I saw a couple of neighbors outside. I asked for help, and one of them, he said he wanted to go check in his vehicle, and he left it in the media, Phantom Blue. And I brought him with you. When we got there, he sees his vehicle underwater. And also, I tell him, you have to stay with me to go to check in my property first before I bring you back. He said, okay, no problem. I know no place to go. When we got to Cleveland, I saw my tenant over there, and he's elevate all his electronics, like value property, up to the second floor. And I check and I saw one phone working. Let me go back before I got there. Before I get to Claiborne, I hear the voice asking for help because the canoe very quiet. And I start getting closer and closer. I got to the house and I got find where the noise come from. I opened the door because the door be swollen. I have to kick it open. I saw old lady inside, and she's the water up to her shoulder. And she's very old, like in the 80s. And she's like my grandma. That was why I seen my eyes first I saw her.
Mm-hmm.
And she's begging me, say, please take me out of here. And I say, okay, I brought her to the porch. She said, I can't stay for long because my foot not too good to stay for long on my feet. And I said, I'll be trying to get you some help and coming right back.
So if I could just jump in here, I'm sorry, just a little. You save this woman who's 80 years old, who's been floating in the water for a day, and you gradually, it's kind of a Mad Max scene, but gradually you and some friends, another Syrian-born man and two others, you sort of huddle and have your own base of operations, if you will, but you're struck that every time you ask for help, you're met with hostility. Is that accurate, would you say, Dave? Have I summarized that correctly?
Well, you know, there were lots of National Guard soldiers in the city and lots of police officers from New Orleans and other cities. And I think in those first few days, there were a number of occasions where Zaytoun and those with him and trying to help people and bring attention to elderly citizens stuck in their homes weren't able to get the attention of the soldiers. They would, especially that first day when Zaytoun and his neighbor tried to flag down National Guard soldiers that were going by Claiborne on fan boats. They couldn't get their attention. They swerved around them. They went about their business, and so it was frustrating for Zaytoun because he said, "Hey, there's this woman. You know, she's dying in her home. She's just a few blocks away. Can you come and help her?" But he wasn't able to get help, and finally they were able to flag down a fishing boat with a couple young men that were just independent, not affiliated with any agency, and those guys came with their motorboat and were able to rescue this woman because, of course, she wouldn't fit on the canoe.
And what happens, Dave, when over and over again Zaytoun's wife, who has fled to join relatives and then friends. She's as far away, I think, as Phoenix. She finally drives 1,500 miles. It's exhausting with four kids and the dog. And she and Zaytoun are able to keep in touch one time a day because one phone line is still above water. But one day, it all absolutely goes south. Would you just tell us what happens?
Well, yeah, Kathy had said, you know, Kathy really wanted
this is Zaytoun's wife.
Yeah, well, Kathy wanted him to leave the city and, and be safe and come join them. But he was determined that he was being useful, that he was needed in the city. He was doing a lot of good. He was helping save lives and feed dogs. And she said, okay, well, you can stay, but I understand. And just make sure you call me every day at noon. And so he did for a week. And then one day there was no phone call. And she was in Phoenix, and there's no call. And days go by. And finally, we realized, or it was many weeks before she knew where her husband was, but Zaytoun and one of his tenants, and Nasser Dayoub, a friend of his from Syria, and one other man who was in the home using the phone, were arrested on suspicion of looting by a consortium of local police, New Mexico police officers, National Guardsmen, and mercenaries. They broke into the home with machine guns and bulletproof vests and threw them all onto a boat and processed them very roughly and then brought them to a makeshift outdoor prison that had been erected right after the storm, and that prison was called Camp Greyhound.
And, of course, they didn't realize what was happening. Zaytoun, what did you think then? Did you realize that you were under suspicion and likely to be held a long time? What was going through your mind?
After what, from beginning, what we got arrested part of the boat, because I asked him, where are you taking us? He said, well, let's go talk to my boss. And soon we brought us to Napoleon and St. Charles, and soon the
boat... To some other streets. He took you to some other place.
Mm-hmm. No, from my house, he brought me to a station over there by Napoleon St. Charles.
Mm-hmm.
And soon we got there, like five, six military guys jumping us like we, I don't know, like big fish or some kind of criminal. I don't know what the guy thinking.
Like you were terrorists.
Worse than that, maybe. I don't know. Like all of them jumping us like very roughly and like, I mean, we don't have no weapon. We don't have nothing. All have T-shirt and short and me. And handcuffed us very, very rough and trousers. And have a van with a white van parking inside. And we stay in the van for a half hour almost. One guy sit in the van. I say, what happened? And he said, I don't know. I'm from Indiana. We're doing our job.
Mm-hmm. He said, I'm from Indiana and we're doing our job.
Exactly. And also in my house, when the guy take us off, I have a piece of paper like 10 foot away from me. I have my wife and my family phone numbers. I begging him to let me have it in case I need to make phone calls. He never let me step one step back to the house.
Right, so you couldn't get the phone number to call your wife.
Exactly.
In Arizona.
Anyway, if I have it, doesn't help because they never let us to use phone over there too. Never had a chance to use any phone.
Mm-hmm. And Dave, as you describe it, it slowly dawns on Zaytoun and the others arrested with him that this isn't just about being detained for possible looting.
Well, when they got to Camp Greyhound, the whole there were hundreds of military personnel there. It was a staging ground for the National Guard, and also there was Burl Kane, the warden of Angola prison, had sort of set up this prison operation. And so there were all kinds of guards from Angola and also trustees, prisoners themselves, who had helped erect this prison. So it was a highly militarized station. And so when they arrived, they were some of the earliest prisoners to be detained at Camp Greyhound, and the whole camp was ready for their arrival, it seemed, and they took great notice of them. And once they gathered all of their what they had on them, Nasser, his friend from Syria, had, of course, had his life savings on him because a lot of people who were in the city after the storm kept all of their belongings and what was most precious to them close because for fear that it might mm-hmm. get washed away or stolen. And so there was cash on these men, and there were some computer jump drives, and camera discs and, things that when they laid them all out on a table, it seemed to indicate some to the law enforcement officers there that there was something larger happening here. There was might be some vast conspiracy. And that's when words like Taliban and Al-Qaeda started getting thrown around to the men. And they were strip searched one by one and interrogated and then thrown in this outdoor cage. Repeatedly visited by different law enforcement officers and questioned, and things became they got darker by the moment and more serious by the moment, and they, it seemed like the entire camp and all of the officials there really felt like they had caught a big fish with these men.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit more about the building of Camp Greyhound just 48 hours after the storm hits, when the government got so little into the Superdome, only blocks away. But let's take a call here, because we have Mohammed, who's calling from Lexington, Virginia. Hello, Mohammed.
Hello. How are you?
Fine, thank you. What's your question, please?
Actually, I was just calling to say hi to Zaytoun. I remember him. He probably doesn't remember me from New Orleans. We prayed at the same mosque near Tulane University, and I remember he was always very helpful when help was needed with painting and construction work at the mosque. And I just wanted to say that, and I'm glad that this story has been written.
Well, thank you for that thought. Zaytoun, do you... Mohammed, have you now left New Orleans?
Yes, I left New Orleans in 2001.
Mm-hmm.
That was before Katrina.
Right. Thank you. So, Zaytoun, how did you feel when one of these soldiers or military people turned to you and said, you guys are Qaeda, you guys are Taliban?
For first, I think this guy's joking, like, because the way we look. And after that, I saw this guy's serious. And when the how I figured out when one from Homeland Security come and interview us there, and he left, he said, we have nothing in him. And I said, this guy's, you know, this guy's serious.
Dave, the other thing is that it's not just that they're detained under suspicion and denied making phone calls or seeing a lawyer or anything like that. You write about incredible abuse that goes on for these prisoners almost from the second they're in this place. I mean, first of all, they don't have what you would have in most prisons. They don't have any place to lie down. Their bed is the pavement. There isn't any blanket. There isn't any privacy. There isn't, you know. But even beyond that, you said they're treated roughly, but they were more than that.
Well, you know, this happened to some of the other prisoners more so than Zaytoun. Zaytoun and Nasser and the others were in one cage, four men in one cage. And there were, you know, a dozen or so other cages all connected. It looked like a large kennel, but for people. And in these other cages, there were prisoners from Orleans Parish Prison and who were being, you know, who had been evacuated from there and were being processed and sent out to other maximum security prisons around the state. And those prisoners, if they were seen to be misbehaving in any way, or especially if they were to touch the fence, you weren't allowed to touch the fence. And if you were caught touching the fence, you would be taken out of the cage, handcuffed, and put face down on the pavement, and then pepper sprayed in your face. After they did that, they would douse the prisoner with water and then return them to the cage. And so there was some pretty rough treatment happening, and all the other prisoners were, you know, had to, you know, endure the pepper spray in the air all day and all night, and the screaming of the prisoners. And so it was a very incredibly hellish place that just didn't seem possible when, of course, people were suffering and just a few blocks away at the Superdome.
Mr. Zaytoun, I know you were reunited with your family eventually, and your business is doing well now, but how many days were you in this Camp Greyhound?
We stayed 3 days.
How much weight did you lose while you were there in the 23 days?
And the worst thing happened there. We have a huge engine, the train engine
that generated power for the whole place.
Yes, next to my head. Mm. Imagine, you know, have 3 days, like maybe 30,000 horsepower engine running, trade, never stop.
Well,
like a few feet away.
We are going to continue to tell your story and what happened to you and your family and your wife in the next part of our show, but we really want to thank you for sharing your story with us and speaking with us.
You're welcome.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking with author Dave Eggers about his new book, Zaytoun, which tells the story of one man's harrowing experiences in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. Dave, would you tell us more about Camp Greyhound? I was so struck reading this. I had not heard about this place, and it's, you know, we say makeshift, but makeshift doesn't describe the purposeful way that this thing was designed and put into place just hours after the storm hit, at the same time that FEMA is not responding to people who are lingering in the Superdome just blocks away.
Well, that struck me, and I think it struck a lot of legal experts after, and a lot of human rights advocates, that, you know, while FEMA was really fumbling and people were suffering at the convention center and Superdome blocks away and still being rescued from their roofs and trying to claw their way out of their attics, there was this incredibly efficient operation happening where the employees of Angola bust down and, you know, a number of trustees, a lot of people doing life sentences were all bust down into the city while people were trying to get out. And they erected this, you know, gleaming, barbed wire-topped, incredibly sturdy outdoor prison. And
a place that looked to a lot of, from photographs, like what we're seeing of Guantanamo.
Well, you know, prisoners were made to sleep and on the cement. There were just porta-potties in each cage. Most of the prisoners were wearing orange jumpsuits. And so, and because it's all, you know, there's no walls, it's just fencing, it did have, it bore a striking resemblance to Guantanamo, and that was one of the first things that Zaytoun and others that were there thought of. And so that was one of the, you know, more depressing things for an Arab American to be thinking about, like having seen these images and heard about other Arab Americans sort of disappearing into the system, to think, uh-oh, you know, here we are, right after the storm, where could this go? And, you know, he was in Greyhound for 3 days, but then brought to a maximum security prison in St. Gabriel, Louisiana, Hunt Correctional Center, and there he was denied all access to anybody. He wasn't even allowed to leave his cell.
He's in solitary confinement.
Yeah, for weeks. And at that point, all that one can think is, you know, without any contact, any phone calls, no legal representation, no charges being, he wasn't notified of any formal charges. You know, a mind can go to some dark places thinking that there might not be a chance that he would ever get out.
Well, this is the point at which the story goes from thriller to Kafka, because he knows there's a system against him, but how to fight it, there's no key that can fit the lock. In the meantime, his wife has figured out that this isn't a case of him simply is hardly the word, but of his case, of a matter of him having died, that he is locked up someplace.
Well, finally, after weeks of going through this process, you can imagine she has her kids with her. She's in Phoenix with friends. She doesn't hear from her husband for 2 weeks. And all she can imagine is, because at that point the city was overrun with law enforcement and it was under control and people, almost everybody had been evacuated, all she can think is that her incredibly hardy, resourceful husband, who hasn't called her and hasn't reached her through any means, one could only assume that he's dead. And it's the only explanation, because otherwise he would have left the city or called in some way. And then finally she gets a call one day from a missionary who had been working at Hunt Correctional Center and had been passing through the cell where Zaytoun was being held. And Zaytoun begged him, gave him the phone number, his wife's cell phone number, and begged him to call Kathy in Phoenix and just tell her that he was alive and where he was. And this missionary the next day did so. And so she got a very brief phone call that said, "I saw your husband. He's at Hunt, St. Gabriel, Louisiana. I got to go." And he hung up. And at that point, she knew where he was at least. And to her, it was a relief to know that, of course, he was alive and in a certain place. To the family in Syria, this was even, to some extent, more worrisome. And when they found out that he was deep in a maximum security prison in a rural area of Louisiana, they were almost more worried than they were knowing that he was in New Orleans after the storm.
Yeah. And you're right that Kathy did the math about how many guns had come into the city with all the different security operations there. But that FEMA, of course, after 9/11, is folded into Department of Homeland Security. And there's a group called the Red Cell Group that is thinking about terrorist plans that might befall somehow during the middle of a hurricane. Not quite sure how that's supposed to work, but that it's part that the CIA's in this, the Marines, the corporate security firms, yet another company called Sandia National Laboratories, and that Zaytoun is the target of this massive blueprint. I mean, it really boggles the mind.
Well, you know, it wasn't, I think it's more sort of systemic dysfunction than it is, you know, them targeting him necessarily. But there was this very interesting document that's declassified. Anybody can get it online, that was put together by what they call the Red Cell Group, that was sort of a think tank to think about the worst things that terrorists could do. And this was, you know, after 9/11, there were a lot of these groups formed, and they would brainstorm blue sky thinking, like, well, and one of the documents that they concocted was called How Terrorists Might Exploit a Hurricane. And it goes through all of the different ways that terrorists might, you know, either sleeper cells or people swooping in after a hurricane and destabilizing the country at a point where we're already somewhat crippled. And so this was sort of the atmosphere that this happened in. And you know, FEMA had been folded into Homeland Security in 2003, and the focus and funding of FEMA changed somewhat after that. And there was a very large concentration on anti-terror measures, and it was and a change from, you know, the way that FEMA was run under Clinton. And so all of these things maybe conspired to create a posture or an environment where something like this was possible, where FEMA was paying for the incarceration of these, you know, thousands of prisoners that were spread all over this state, and there wasn't any due process. There wasn't any, you know, habeas corpus had been suspended. There was no way to sort of challenge one's incarceration. And the whole Louisiana legal system had sort of collapsed. Mm-hmm. And so there were, Zaytoun was among many hundreds that were caught up in this system, and they did what they called Katrina time, which meant just sort of this purgatory where they had no way to escape or challenge their incarceration, no legal representation.
In fact, through his wife's efforts, he gets out far in advance of other people arrested with him. Let's take a call here. Bonnie is calling from New Orleans. Hello, Bonnie.
Hi, and hello, Dave. I met you a few weeks ago at a signing here in New Orleans, and I quickly read the book, and I just wanted to say thank you so much for telling this story, and sincere thanks to both Zaytoun and Kathy for having the bravery to go through this all again and, you know, have to talk about this years later. I think it's a very important story. I've read way too many Katrina memoirs, but this one really kind of cuts across a lot of different issues that maybe weren't really brought to light, you know, in the immediate aftermath, and that this could really happen anywhere. And I know, Dave, you've focused a lot on human rights in a lot of your writing, and, you know, I just really think that immigrants built this city and have rebuilt this city and have kind of been, you know, fallen in love with this city in spite of the way the city has treated them and the country has treated them, and just their determination to come back and not only, you know, bear witness and rebuild their own lives, but to give back to the community. I know a lot of the proceeds are going to some local charities, which, you know, again, just thank you.
And thank you, Bonnie.
I apologize.
Thank you for that call.
Thank you.
Dave, you have put profits back into the community through the foundation you created after the book, the Zaytoun Foundation. But I'd like to talk about, you know, things that can't always be so easily repaired. Kathy Zaytoun is another victim of this and finds that even after he's freed, that her difficulties go on. Would you read about Kathy's trying to cope with the trauma of her husband's experiences?
Well, this takes place in the fall of 2008 when there's sort of a coda to the book. And I should also say that in 2007 they had a new baby, Ahmed, which they nicknamed Hamoudi, and so he's mentioned here. Kathy is working less these days. There's the baby to care for, and her mind is not sharp enough, not lately, to handle all the paperwork on her own. They have some help now from Ambata, their assistant, and others, which gives Kathy some room to breathe, to be a mother, to make sense of the last 3 years. There are appointments with doctors, doctors to figure out why her hands go numb without warning, doctors to investigate her digestive problems, memory problems. Doctors have asked Kathy what she thinks the most traumatic part of the Katrina experience was. She surprised herself and the doctors when she realized that it was after she knew Zaytoun was alive and had been told he was at Hunt Correctional Center, but wasn't allowed to see him or even know where a court hearing might be held. It was that moment, being told by the woman on the phone that the hearing's location was, quote, private information, that did the most damage. I felt cracked open, she says. That this woman, a stranger, could know her despair and desperation and simply deny her, that there could be trials without witnesses, that her government could make people disappear. It broke me, she says.
And this is the lingering feeling that she has. Her illness really still has not been diagnosed. Somebody has suggested post-traumatic stress syndrome, but we don't really know, right?
Well, at this point, she does know that she was suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome, and she's been treated now, and she's getting a lot of help, and she's doing much better now that they know what it is. And she was having a lot of problems with disorientation and finding herself. There's a scene where she finds herself just trying to deposit money at the bank that she's done 1,000 times. And suddenly she looks down at her checkbook and the pen in her hand, and she doesn't know what they're doing. She doesn't know what the pen is for. She doesn't know why this checkbook is here. She doesn't know where she is. And she has to just sit there for a few minutes and concentrate while the bank teller is saying, are you okay? Are you okay? And she has lost total track of who she is and where she is. And this is something that happens to them a lot. It even happens to Zaytoun, this incredibly hardy guy. Every so often he'll be driving in the city and will forget where he is and where he's going. And there's thousands of New Orleanians that have suffered from and are still suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome. And a lot of these symptoms are very similar among people who lived through the storm and even those who fled and came back.
Let's take a call from Paula. She's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Paula.
Hi there. You know, I was wondering if any official or anyone has apologized to Zaytoun while he was being so heroic and helping people, possibly through misunderstanding and good intentions, that our country arrested and detained him. I was wondering if anyone apologized.
Or to any of the other, as you put it, people who did Katrina time, although they were completely innocent. Was there a public apology?
I have not heard one. I've been looking. I did a book about wrongful incarceration called Surviving Justice, and apologies from those who, either on the DA level or, you know, the prison officials or, I mean, it's very, very rare to get a public apology because it weakens their position for any civil suit. And so there's been the Zaytouns and many others have filed civil suits against the state, the city, the DA, law enforcement, you name it. And to my knowledge, none of these lawsuits have gained traction or going anywhere. And so,
did track down two of the initial arresting, I don't even know if I should say officers. I guess one was a policeman from out of state, and you found them.
Yeah, I tracked down the two guys that were on the arrest record. One was Donald Lima, a New Orleans police officer, and the other was Ralph Gonzalez, who had come from New Mexico to help out. And, you know, they both meant well, but they were very agitated during that time. There was, you know, Ralph Gonzalez from New Mexico was very open and frank about the fact that when he came into the city, he was expecting a war zone. They had been led to believe through the information they'd got and some media coverage and images that they'd seen that this was going to be Fallujah in New Orleans. And of course, when they showed up, they just found a lot of tired, helpless, thirsty and starving people that needed help. So they immediately went from a posture of command and control to search and rescue. But this was, emblematic of the, you know, mentality that was in place at that time, that Donald Lima, the main arresting officer from New Orleans, thought it could be possible that these four men were, you know, operating a pretty vast looting operation out of their home.
Yeah. Can I ask you something that I just felt almost foolish as I was reading this book? I mean, I'm a journalist. I've covered maximum security, the Middle East. I certainly wasn't at New Orleans until a month after the storm hit. Why did we not know more about the story? You said you had it in your McSweeney series, but why did we not know more about people who did Katrina time?
Well, you know, there was a lot of coverage by a lot of great journalists in New Orleans. And, you know, starting with those at the Times-Picayune, who, of course, won a Pulitzer Prize deservedly, and they did incredible work. So they covered it pretty early on and ongoing. And there were a lot of other smaller organizations and citizen journalists that covered it. And there's even video that you can find online that, footage of the prison while it was operating. And but why it didn't get wider attention, I'm not exactly sure. And I think that, you know, the prisoners did need to be evacuated from Orleans Parish Prison, which was flooded. And so there needed to be a plan in place. And so this was considered the best plan under the circumstances. But I think that what passed for normal during and after the storm, I think, is sort of shocking to, the rest of us elsewhere in the country. And I think that it's just something that I think needs to be examined by the legal system and by the state law enforcement and the city, and sort of how could we have done this better, and what will we do next, and by FEMA and Homeland Security, like how can we ensure that this never happens again if there is another disaster somewhere in the country, and how can we ensure that rights, human rights, are preserved even during a crisis?
Right. Well, Dave Eggers, thanks very much for joining us and for writing this book. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website at onpointradio.org and follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Again, Dave, thanks. This is, I think, an absolutely essential story. Thanks so much. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.